Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. And we've got a really interesting show today. We're going to be talking with David Smithwick, a pharmacist and owner of Southern Village Pharmacy in Chapel Hill, about community pharmacists, community pharmacies. A really interesting topic, something that we used to have tens and tens of thousands. Most pharmacies in most communities were probably community pharmacists and community pharmacies. Nowadays, it may be unusual for people to have heard those terms and to actually see or go to a community pharmacy. We'll be talking about that, and I'm looking forward to that conversation. First, though, we're going to talk about some research that matters. These are the types of research that sometimes, you know, when you hear it, you might be thinking of doing something different in your life. Perhaps when you hear it, you may actually stop doing something you're doing. These are the types of research on your health that we like to bring up. Things that perhaps you've heard about. Maybe you don't know the slant that we take on these issues. Oftentimes, we think you may not have heard about it. One that we want to talk about today first is actually research that was in a journal called Aggressive Behavior. This was a really interesting article that was a survey of 2,000 teenagers between the ages of 14 and 17, both African-American and white teenagers, and they were looking at their exposure to TV and film violence, as well as conflict in the homes, and how this actually played out in terms of aggressive behavior. Now, I know everyone out there saying, we know the outcome here, we know the punchline here. Yes, those teenagers who were exposed to more film violence on TV and were exposed to more levels of household conflict were certainly at more risk of aggressive behaviors. That's probably why it was published in this particular journal. But what was really interesting and why we're talking about it is that parental monitoring seem to actually help protect against this aggressive behavior. So what do we talk about when we think about parental monitoring? So parents who attempt to supervise media use, such as restricting or forbidding viewing of violence or adult content, parents who have discussions about media violence with their children, showing that oftentimes six people could die and there are no consequences sometimes for this. What are the ramifications of how this plays out in real life? What's happening with sensation seeking? And so they actually found that those who had this high media violence exposure, but yet there was this parental monitoring that was actually less aggression. It actually helped provide this protective impact against things like impulsivity, sensation seeking, and it probably even lowered some family conflict. These are the sorts of things that it's not just the media violence alone, because we know that that is a strong factor for aggressive and violence. However, all the other factors that teens are exposed to at school, on the TV, in neighborhoods, reading about things across the world. It's a difficult area. I think as parents, as providers, we need to have conversations. And it appears that the conversation itself could be protective. Second research that matter we'll talk about, I think, is even in some respects really relevant to everything that's happening around the Me Too movement, the things that are happening on Capitol Hill. And this is about sexual violence. In this particular case, we're really talking about sexual violence with women. This was in the journal Frontiers in Neuroscience, and it showed that women who had suffered from sexual violence, and we know that this is epidemic, 1 out of 5 college women will experience sexual violence a lifetime. history of sexual violence among women is significantly greater than that, and that many of these women haven't been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, but yet the women who have had this sexual violence, even those not diagnosed, have intense memory that can be decades later after the violence has occurred. And this study actually was of 183 college-age women between the ages of 18 and 39, and 64 of these women said that they were victims of sexual violence, and less than 10% were on medication. And these women did have such strong memories with details and vividness, one might think that they actually did have post-traumatic stress disorder, but it just wasn't diagnosed. And every time they think about these old memories, they develop a new memory in their brains. It's retrieved, and this continues to have a re-victimization and trauma. So this suggests that as all the things that have been coming about in society over the last number of months, that it really is bringing out a lot more that was there but hasn't been discussed and talked about. And what I really liked about this particular research is they also talked about these researchers developing a new therapy rather than what's called prolonged exposure therapy, which people are trained to recollect the traumatic memory during interviews and then do journaling and maybe revisiting to help deal with this, which is one therapy. They have one called mental and physical training therapy, and it's 30 minutes of mental training with silent meditation and then 30 minutes of aerobic exercise twice a week for 6 weeks. And this appeared to actually diminish the symptoms of those who had the violence, less trauma-related thoughts, less thinking about the past. There's so much work to be done here. I think if our listeners have experienced sexual violence, please talk with your physician. Let them know about this type of research. Let them know about ways of meditation and exercise in addition to justice, which frequently we discover hasn't always been done. The last research that matters is about a subject that I have to pay attention to, and probably many providers and healthcare professionals, which is about having a regular bedtime. We probably go to bed too late, get up too early, don't get enough sleep. And we think about the lack of sleep as a major barrier. And we know that the lack of really good sleep is related to heart disease, diabetes, all kinds of health problems. And this research was actually done by colleagues at Duke University here in North Carolina. And they were looking at what's called sleep regularity, also called sleep hygiene. And particularly not just the amount of sleep, but looking at, do you go to bed at the same time each night and do you get up at the same time each morning? So you get into a pattern. And they looked at sleep cycles of almost 2,000 adults, most of whom were close to 70 years of age. And they really found that people who had this high sleep irregularity went to bed much later. They were more sleepy during the day than regular sleepers. They had all kinds of sleep disturbances, and they had a higher obesity, high blood pressure, diabetes, greater stress, greater depression. And this, rather than the amount of sleep and the timing, the sleep regularity was actually one of the strongest predictors of these adverse health outcomes. It suggests that you really need to build a pattern. I'm committing that I'm going to bed at a much more consistent time. I prefer 10:30 rather than 11:30. And I will get up more regularly at 6:30 rather than 7. A very consistent time frame here. We'll see if it does improve the sleep regularity. I think our listeners can probably benefit from this research too. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with David Smithwick about community pharmacies and community pharmacist. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, I'm going to be talking with David Smithwick, pharmacist and owner of Southern Village Pharmacy in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, about the role of a community pharmacist. Welcome to Your Health, Mr. Smithwick.
Thank you, Adam.
You know, it's really interesting to think about having someone who represents a community pharmacist. And I imagine today, kind of like the private practitioner in my field and a kind of a solo practitioner or a small practice, people just don't think that that's still kind of there. What? Tell us about that path and how you got into starting a community pharmacy.
When I first got out of pharmacy school in 1991, I went down and moved to Beaufort. And I lived in Beaufort for a couple years, and I worked at a Revco in Beaufort. And my dad's from Moorhead. I wanted to go down, live at the beach, did a lot of fishing, enjoyed it. And then towards the second year I was down there, I actually had considered opening up a pharmacy myself. I've always been very entrepreneurial, mowed about 20 lawns a summer when I was a kid, and I always enjoyed working and being entrepreneurial. And so I thought about doing it. At the time, I was younger, and I actually ended up moving back to Chapel Hill. And I worked for a few more years at Carr Drugs, worked at Carr Drugs at University Mall, which used to be very, very close to where we're at right now. And then after a few years at Carr Drugs in 98, I decided to go back and get my MBA. So went back to business school at Keenan Flagler, got my MBA. And then when I got out, I went to work for GSK. So I worked in the pharma industry.
GlaxoSmithKline, big pharmaceutical company. Yep.
So did that for 13 years and enjoyed that thoroughly. But always in the back of my mind was owning my own business and controlling my own destiny. And one of my roles at GSK, we interacted with a gentleman who is a supply chain expert in the pharmaceutical supply chain. With wholesalers, retailers, and his name is Adam Fine, and we worked with Adam every once in a while, and Adam had a couple articles about the state of independent pharmacy today, and while I was at Glaxo at the time, I was approaching 50 and read a couple of his articles that got the juices flowing again around opening up a drugstore, and I was like, you know, either I'm going to do it now, or it's not going to happen. And, you know, I enjoyed working there a lot, and we helped people. But there was somewhat of a disconnect between what you're doing working for a company like that and the people on the receiving end of your help. And I missed kind of being able to help people directly and get to know the folks that we're providing assistance to. And so I missed that. And decided to take the big leap and do it. You know, there's a lot of risk associated with it, but there was also the strong desire to do it and realizing that, you know, getting ready to turn 50, it was either go for it or not have that, I guess you would call it dream occur.
Well, I know there's tons of patients, and I've got some of them who are appreciative of that decision. And before we get into understanding a little bit more really about what you're, I wonder how frequently is the community pharmacy? Is it something that was really frequent before the ages of these big, because it probably was every, you know, most communities probably had a community pharmacy. I knew there was one in Chapel Hill when I first moved here, and slowly that one kind of went away. And is there a movement back towards it, or is it a really still kind of a specialty niche?
Well, there's a lot of thought out there that independent pharmacy is on the decline. It's going away. When I worked at GSK, part of what I did was working with the retail pharmacy industry, or whatever you would like to call it. And so if you actually look at the data, the number of independent pharmacies in the United States over the last 20 years has actually been relatively flat. So
what are we talking about?
I think there's somewhere around 30,000 in the United States.
That's far more than I would have thought.
30, yeah. Maybe it might be up as north of 40. Yeah. I can't remember. It was about 5.5 years ago when I left. So, but you know, it used to be, like you said, back in the day, it was pretty much the, you know, it was all independent. And then I would guess maybe in the 70s, back when I was young kid, you started seeing the advent of some of the change. And then there was a lot of conglomeration and mergers and acquisitions that occurred and still are occurring today that have resulted in a few of the big chains.
Well, before we take a break, I want to ask a question because I know that the benefits are immense. And we're going to really, I think, when we come back from break, I really want to talk about kind of the benefits and the nuts and bolts. But there's a significant difficulty, I think, at least from the outside looking in, which is how do you provide and can get the cost of the medications? Because, you know, many pharmacy chains look at Walmart and say it's the big gorilla on the head. And when they're, you know, giving all of their drugs at $4 and they're making their margin on toys or something else, you're making your margin on selling pharmaceuticals. How do you compete when the price seems to be something that the large gorillas control?
Well, you reference Walmart. I think if you were to go and look at the list of medications on the $4, whatever their program is called, it's not a large number of prescriptions. And for the most part, the majority of folks out there have insurance, either commercial insurance or through Medicare Part D. And with the vast majority of the commercial plans out there, the actual cost of the medication to the person is the same wherever they go. So, you know, then your competition becomes more like, how much does it cost me to get the medication relative to some of these other folks? But on the other end, in terms of you being able to attract and retain customers, aside from a few, you know, there's a couple Part D plans that have preferred networks, but for the majority of folks, they can go to, you know, whatever drugstore they want to, and in most cases, the copay will be the same. So then it really becomes competing on customer service. And quite frankly, that's an easy parameter to compete with some of the big guys on.
Well, we're going to dive into that in just a second, but we're going to need to take a short break. We're having a really fascinating conversation with David Smithwick, pharmacist and owner of a community pharmacy, Southern Village Pharmacy in Chapel Hill, about the role of a community pharmacist. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us. This is Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we've been talking with David Smithwick, pharmacist and owner of Southern Village Pharmacy in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, about the role of a community pharmacist. And right before the break, David, we were talking about this really a distinguishing element in an age where cost may not be as big of a factor because the insurance will pay for large portions of it, that service becomes a defining characteristic. How does that play out in a way that's tangible on a day-to-day basis? You know, when I'm thinking about it, I don't have a relationship with my pharmacist right now. I get something in the telephone that, you know, it's time to pick it up, and I kind of go there and pick it up. But a lot of times, perhaps I would like a relationship, but I've not thought about it. How does that play out for you?
Probably some of the best examples relate to helping folks navigate the complexity of their insurance and their out-of-pocket costs with medications.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, sure. There's a big shift in the marketplace towards high-deductible plans, both on the major medical side, I would imagine, but also on the pharmacy side. And a lot of times, folks will come in and they'll get a medication. And like my plan now, I have a $7,000 deductible. So until I hit that, I'm paying the full cost of the medication. So there, you know, I have the benefit of having worked in the industry a long time and knowing how all the different pieces work. It's complex. But I can oftentimes, if somebody comes in and they have a medication and the cost is $233 and they have insurance and it's surprising to an individual, which is understandable that, hey, it's $233. Oh my gosh, isn't my insurance paying for it? Well, yes, but we're able to see you have a $5,000 deductible. And so this is going towards your deductible. there could be other medications that would be acceptable or reasonable alternatives that we could explain the situation to your provider and see if any of those other options would be appropriate for your situation.
Like you're given a potent topical steroid cream for which there can be very expensive. There could be a generic that's pretty close that could be much less expensive.
Absolutely. That's a great example. Clobetasol ointment is one of the medications over the last 5 years where we've seen the price go from, you know, on our end, $20 a tube up to $300 for a tube of 60 grams. And so we were able to help some of the dermatologists in town figure out some of the other corticosteroids that had the same similar potency to clobetasol ointment but cost a lot less to the end patient if they had a high deductible plan.
So that really makes sense in terms of being able to do that because it's a philosophy as much as a knowledge base there. What else would be the sort of thing that may not be perfectly obvious as people think about why they might want to consider a community pharmacist compared to a non-community pharmacist? What are some of the other things that you think of? Like I know you mentioned to me the when it's flu season and people perhaps are thinking they need the Tamiflu, the oral medication, but these places could run out of it. You may be less likely to run out of it.
Yeah, we definitely help folks get access to the medications that are prescribed to them. And, you know, one of the things that – one of the advantages that we have is we're able to start to see some of these marketplace trends. I'm sure a lot of folks are aware currently of the shortage of EpiPens that are in the marketplace. And so probably a couple months ago, we were able to start to see that, hey, it's getting harder to order these things, and we're starting to see the quantity available at wholesalers going down. So we have the flexibility to be able to say, okay, well, gosh, if there's going to be a shortage of EpiPens and school's about to start, we need to have them, and why don't we buy 100 of them and get them in stock? And that way, we have enough to supply, and we've done the same thing with Tamiflu as well. We've had enough to supply most of the need for the town when a lot of the larger organizations that don't have that flexibility at the store level to order don't have it in stock. So there's situations like that where we're able to get folks access to medications, and it's strictly due to the fact that we have the ability to look at what's going on in the marketplace and react to it very quickly.
So that flexibility to respond quickly is a valuable attribute. I mean, I know I would appreciate that, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, I know it's frustrating sometimes when you go there, but I imagine sometimes you have to stock a lot of drugs and a lot of medications. So are there times in which, like if it was a more rare drug, you might not have that medication, cancer drug, for instance, that a patient needs, or an opioid that, you know, there are lots of different types. You may not carry them all.
Yeah. And, you know, with some of the medications, some of the more expensive medications, oncology medications, are actually go through specialty pharmacies. So they've actually been taken out of the retail space. So we don't have access to them. You know, we always have to manage our inventory. But, you know, very early on when we opened up, so I opened a store in 2013, and I think the flu season in around Christmas of 13 going into early 14, the flu season was pretty big one, kind of like last year. January, February, March last year was there was a lot of flu, and nobody had Tamiflu. None of the stores had Tamiflu, and especially the liquid for the little kids. And so that's another example of where I was able to see that, hey, flu is hitting pretty hard. I made the decision, you know, which was a difficult decision when you first opened up because it does take a lot of, you know, working capital to purchase the inventory. But I was like, I think it would be a good thing for us to make sure that we have plenty of Tamiflu so that there's Tamiflu in Chapel Hill.
Yeah.
And that people have access to it. And the interesting thing about that was that we ended up getting a lot of new customers because of the fact that they couldn't get it where they were usually going, and they would come in our store and we had it, and they had a great experience coming into our store, and the reason why they came in was because we had it. And we ended up one of the folks interviewed us, I think it was the local feed of NPR, because we were the only folks that had Tamiflu. So, you know, those kind of situations I found have ended up being a good thing, not just to help with public health, but to help our business as well.
I know one of the things that people might be surprised was, I was when I first heard it, was that I had a number of patients get erectile dysfunction and they needed medications for it. And they were always call me back and say, oh my God, even with insurance, it's prohibitively expensive, you know, $20, $30 for a dose. Maybe my insurance plan doesn't even cover it. Why would people bring that problem to the community pharmacy?
Well, in our situation, we had, when I first opened, we had folks that experienced that fact. You know, you run the prescription through, the insurance won't cover it. You send the prior authorization to the prescriber and they have to fill it out and it gets rejected. So it's frustrating for the practitioner because the insurance won't cover it. And then it's actually up, the brand name is up to $70 a tablet right now. I don't understand the pricing strategy. But in our situation, the leading product, the active ingredient is called sildenafil. And the company that originally developed this medication had developed it for pulmonary hypertension. And they had a 20 milligram strength of the medication, which I stumbled across it looking through my wholesalers'
it's cheap.
Offerings, and it's not as expensive as some of the hundreds.
It's not marketed for erectile dysfunction, technically.
Exactly. And so we ended up packaging up a program, for lack of a better way to describe it, where we would do 90 tablets for $75. And if you do the math on that, it would be equivalent to, you know, 18 of the tablets of the 100 milligram brand name, which would cost you over $1,000. So we went out to a lot of the local nurse practitioners, physicians, and explained to them this program that we had where we could kind of eliminate their hassle of dealing with all the insurance requests for prior authorization, which got rejected, and then ultimately get patients access to this active ingredient, this medication,
so they're
at
paying
a very
cash.
Reasonable price.
They're paying cash, but getting it at far cheaper than they probably are able to. And so let me ask you, because we're running a little short on time, two quick questions. One, is there a service you provide that people don't think, like they'd be surprised? Something that you do that might be surprising to a customer at a community pharmacy?
I think the thing that we do that surprises folks the most is just our knowledge of how I call it how the sausage is made in terms of, you know, how their insurance works and helping them navigate it and helping them navigate the cost of their medications.
So they know that you know about the drugs because that's your pharmacist, but they're surprised that you have this detailed knowledge that you can work with collaboratively with a provider to perhaps find a right solution for them works that maybe the provider didn't even know about.
And for the patient too. I think, you know, Medicare Part D is very complicated for folks. For most plans, the first $400 is deductible, and then you kick into the copay phase and benefit stage two, and then after you spend a certain amount, you go into the donut hole. And most of the pharmacists out there are somewhat aware of how it works, but we're able to actually look at the claims data and help people understand where they're at. We're able to help them look at all their medications, even predict, hey, we think you'll go into the donut hole in October, help them kind of navigate what their expenditures are going to be throughout the year.
I can tell this MBA was certainly the knowledge there. As we wrap up, is there any final thought you'd like to leave listeners around the country with?
I would give if you have a community pharmacy in your area, if you have a local independent, give them a shot. I think you'll be satisfied with the customer service that you get. And as for me personally, I know this isn't national, but I ended up in Southern Village, which is just a wonderful place with a wonderful community and great people. And the practitioners in this area are wonderful as well. And so I'm really grateful I ended up doing this 5.5 years ago. It's been great to be a more integrated part of the community. That's part of what gets me going and part of what I think people will experience if they go into independent pharmacies. They'll see the same thing. They'll see people that are committed to their communities.
Well, that's a wonderful thought, and it's a music to many listeners' ears, I'm quite certain. And we want to thank you, David Smithwick, pharmacist and owner of Southern Village Pharmacy in Chapel Hill, for being our guest today on Your Health and really talking to us about what is the role in 2018 and beyond of a community pharmacist and a community pharmacy.
Thank you. Thanks, Adam.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. If any listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, just send a comment to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. We'll take a look at it, and we will try to address it on an upcoming show. I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I'm a young woman who really likes her family doctor. However, I would prefer to have a separate doctor do my gynecology care. I don't want to offend my family doctor, however, since I know he also does gynecology care in his practice. Do you think that's okay?
Oh, of course. I think that's perfectly fine, and it's not so unusual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are some men who are uncomfortable with a female provider, perhaps for a prostate or rectal examination. There are many women who are uncomfortable with a male physician for a gynecology exam. Maybe they're uncomfortable because the family doctor really is involved in lots of elements of their care. Maybe there are things relating to their mental health or physical health or just so many things, and they may feel that they want a separation and a boundary. You know, the simple fact is great majority of family doctors really do practice gynecological care and can do routine gynecological care very well, very competent. And I myself do most of the gynecological care for most of my female patients. But I have female patients who maybe they had a relationship with a gynecologist before they saw me. Maybe they want to see a gynecologist. I say more power, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's you're in control, and we want to give you the best care possible. It's important that we coordinate that care. So if
right.
you're getting your gynecology care from a provider, make sure what they're doing, what you're doing. You don't want to have two different quarterbacks doing the same thing.
Right.
You want to be in agreement on the treatment plans and have records that are communicating there. But pretty easy to do these days.
What should she say to her family doctor? How would you like a patient to approach that?
I think being honest, I think just saying, listen, I really like the care I get. I think, however, I'd like to have someone else provide my female care. It could be a different family doctor.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a female family doctor in the same
sure.
practice. It doesn't have to be a gynecologist. But I don't want to give up everything else. And
right.
I think that's fine. And it'll probably be a good relationship and hopefully a long-lasting one. What's our very next house call?
My mother has suffered from fatty liver disease and cirrhosis for 10 years. She will probably pass away in the next few years because of the liver problems. Am I at risk of these same problems? And if so, what can I do to prevent it from ever happening to me?
You know, fatty liver disease is such a difficult disease. It's really one of the top causes of cirrhosis or really end-stage, ultimately, liver disease in the United States and worldwide. And, you know, we are beginning to know more than we ever have known about it. And it is strongly associated with obesity. It's associated with inflammation in the liver. And just as obesity has lots of genetic causes, so that if you are obese and your parents are obese, it's a good chance that your children will be obese. And we have to intervene and really work at kind of changing some of those underlying genetic tendencies. Fatty liver disease has very similar, but again, a lot of that may well be due to obesity. So how we can intervene to prevent the obesity or to lose weight would really be one of the most important things. I think talking with your doctor, getting tested to see, do you have any inflammation in your liver that could cause these kinds of problems? That would be something that would be really important to try to pick up on it the earliest as possible and do your best to prevent it. Medications that could cause liver disease, you'd probably be more likely to want to avoid those. What's our very next house call?
I'm a 40-year-old woman, and I found out my husband was having affairs with women while traveling. We're seeing a therapist. However, it's not going well, as he blames me for these affairs. The therapy is helpful, but I don't really understand why, in any form or fashion, it's my problem.
I think I'm going to agree. this is really tough. As a family doctor, and most family doctors, particularly if you're caring for families, you do some family therapy.
Right.
It would not be unusual. A lot of times it's not at this level in terms of infidelity. But, you know, betrayal and honesty and trust and, you know, these are all kinds of issues that affect relationships. And how one really begins to understand that and counsel, you know, these families. I think it's great that they're in therapy, because I think this type of situation 100% needs family therapy, and mm-hmm. more cases than not, this sort of relationship does not end in the couple staying together. But that's really up to the couples, and the therapist can really help guide them, I think, towards understanding better themselves. But there's also another issue here, which is that typically in this sort of situation, one or both of the partners really need their own therapist.
That makes sense.
You know, because, you may be hearing one thing in the marriage therapy.
Right.
The marriage therapist is really trying to not play sides and, you know, things. But, you know, in most cases, you know, yeah, there may be some things that each of us can do better. But if one person's choosing to act it out in a certain way, that's a problem, I think. And I think having, you know, multiple affairs, you know, it's like someone who's abuse of the person who's responsible for that is the person that's doing it,
mm-hmm.
not the victim. That seems to me is sometimes re-victimization.
Mm-hmm.
So tough situation.
Yeah, I agree. It sounds like definitely this listener would benefit from having their own personal therapist where they could get out some of those frustrations in a safe setting without their partner there. Would be really helpful.
Yeah. You want people to be built up and feel good about themselves mm-hmm. in all forms and fashions, because, the worst judge of ourselves is not people outside of us. It's ourselves.
Sure. Yeah.
What's our very last house call, Laura?
I've had severe daily acid reflux for years, for which no antacids have helped. I really tolerate it okay now without medications, but I'm curious if there's anything new on the horizon that might help me.
Well, you know, we get so used to seeing acid reflux, you know, and we think about, oh, are we taking certain medications like these non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications like Metoprin, Neupren, Advil, Ibuprofen, Aleve, Naproxen. We can just go on and on,
and on and on and on
and
on.
And even the prescription ones can also do that and cause these stomach irritation. Also, people who have acid reflux for other reasons, perhaps they're having too much caffeine, too mm-hmm. much chocolate, too much alcohol. But assuming those things have been looked at, assuming you've perhaps been on medications that are designed to reduce acid, and you're not on these medications that are causing it, and yet you still have it, that's a special circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who really have, they're just excessive acid producers. And
mm-hmm.
really, in that case, sometimes actually surgery is considered. We might think, oh, that's radical. But I've seen people's lives transformed by surgery at the right person for the right disease at the right time, and it's curative often. So you make it so that they actually can't reproduce acid. Now, the problem is that some of these surgeries may involve they actually can't vomit either.
Oh, yikes.
But, you know, most people would say, oh, that's okay, I don't want to vomit. That's such a bad thing.
That's true.
But there are some other approaches. I would say in this particular case, it's helpful to sometimes not only talk to your family doctor, talk with perhaps a gastroenterologist mm-hmm. specialist, even a gastroenterology surgeon, to see what options are available.
Mm-hmm. Very good candidate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's going to conclude your health today. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to your health. Any questions or stories, you can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, David Smithwick. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.